Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters. We're going to be welcoming three guests today as we await the new sexenio in Mexico, which starts December 1. André Dorce Ramos will discuss what the incoming presidency might bring to the media landscape and the prospect of reform. Then John Bellamy Foster joins us to explain the global financial crisis and what it holds in store for the US and other countries. Finally, we turn to a new report on the media in the UK with our last guest. That'll be Bill Grantham. Joining us now is Dr. André Dorce Ramos, a lecturer researcher at the Communication Sciences Department in the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana Coajimalpa in Mexico City. In addition to those academic duties, André is also ombudsman with the public broadcasting Canal 22, Channel 22, and is currently working on a book about critical perspectives on media convergence, as well as collaborating with several local and regional initiatives for progressive change in media legislation in Mexico. Okay. So we're having a little difficulty getting through to André Dorce Ramos. And for that reason, what we're going to do is move to the person who was scheduled to be our third guest, namely Bill Grantham. Bill Grantham is an attorney here in Los Angeles whose practice focuses on the representation of a wide range of clients in connection with the development, financing, production, and exploitation of motion pictures, television programs, and other content forms. Bill has also worked as a management consultant, advising major media interests, as a media executive, and as a journalist specializing in the international entertainment industry. Well, Bill, thanks for coming in at slightly short notice. We knew you were going to be here today, but you didn't know you were going to be in quite this early. Welcome. And tell us all about this Leveson inquiry, so-called, which is just reported today. I actually just arrived from London about an hour and a half ago. And while I was in the air, the Leveson report released 2,000 pages. And I'm sure you've read every last one of them.
Every single one. There's an executive summary, an abbreviated version, which is a mere 56 pages. And as you can imagine, there's been an enormous amount of commentary. So we're still trying to wrap our head around it. But what this is it's an inquiry into the practices of the British press, the print media principally. And it derives from some scandals, which some of us may remember. I was actually on this show a few months ago talking about the one that actually started this inquiry, which was a Rupert Murdoch-owned newspaper called The News of the World, which hacked into the phone of a missing teenager who eventually turned up dead in an attempt to find her her voicemail messages and to obtain material for their rather salacious and sensational coverage of this terrible tragedy. And the public reaction was just so extraordinarily angry and antagonistic that Murdoch closed the paper within two or three days, fired a couple of hundred journalists, and this report was this inquiry was commissioned to look overall into the practices of the press, the criminality through illegal phone hacking and bribery, the relationship of the press and the police, the relationship of the press and the political class, and now quite remarkably quickly, considering the 2,000 pages, over 330 witnesses, several hundred written submissions made, they've now reported.
And some of the witnesses included not only, in a sense, ordinary people from ordinary walks of life whose privacy had been invaded, but also Hollywood stars. Hugh Grant, for example, was not only a witness, but was quite prominent, wasn't he, in various social movements that were trying to make sure that the government of the day took whatever recommendations came very seriously.
Well, if you think of phone hacking, and just to understand what that is, it really is a method of getting into somebody's mobile phone, getting to their voicemails, and listening into the messages that are being left for them. And well, I'm not going to reveal how this is done. Although, if you were to ask Piers Morgan at CNN, he'd be prepared to explain very clearly for you. It's pretty easy. And newspapers, not just the Murdoch papers, a lot of papers, were doing this very, very widely. And it did involve big stars, Hugh Grant, Russell Brand, Paul McCartney, Brad Pitt. It involved politicians, the wife of the former British Prime Minister, Cherry Blair, the wife of Tony Blair, royals like Camilla Parker Bowles, all sorts of great good and the celebrated. That, of course, gave a huge sort of dynamic, a huge push to the inquiry itself.
Now, and this inquiry was not about television, radio, or the totality of the internet. It's more about newspapers, isn't it? And in Britain, the newspapers are quite different from the way they're organized here, aren't they?
Well, the first thing is, you have an enormous amount of competition. I mean, if you're here in Los Angeles and you go to a newsstand, you'll see the Los Angeles Times. If you live in the Valley, you'll see the Daily News. You'll see La Opinion, and you may see the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, one or two other non-local newspapers. In Britain, you go to a newsstand in the morning, you will see 12 national newspapers of all sorts, ranging from, you know, the heavyweight to the tabloid, all trying to get your buck to buy them. It's an incredibly competitive newspaper environment, one of the most competitive in the world.
And because it's a physically small country compared to this, with really only one time zone, you're also seeing the potential for being a national newspaper, whereas here there are really only a couple that manage to do that, aren't there?
Yes, here there's the Wall Street Journal, which is specialized. There's the New York Times. There's USA Today, but that's really for hotels and places like that. There isn't a national press in this country in the same way as there are in other countries. And Britain, although there is quite a dynamic regional press in Britain, national papers are not only, as I said, very competitive, they are also major conveyors of news and information. That's to say, radio is very important, television is very important, as here, the internet is very important, but newspapers are still really important. Even though their circulations are way down for the same reasons as newspapers are down everywhere else. The top Murdoch papers sell over 2 million copies a day. There are other papers that are up over the 1 to 2 million sale. A lot of people are reading them. A lot of people's opinions and views are formed by what they read in the newspapers.
And the newspapers also have very distinctive ideological perspectives, don't they? So just as with Murdoch's property Fox News Channel here on cable TV in the US, where it's very obvious that it's pushing a far-right Republican perspective, so the Sun newspaper, a daily tabloid, has a particular position, doesn't it?
Well, yes. And the British press, maybe sort of 8 out of the 12 daily papers, you know, are to some extent or other conservative or right wing. And the left wingness of the remaining four is, you know, somewhat, it moves around a bit, let me put it that way. The ideological tilt of the papers is very important. It's also very important the stylistics. The closest newspaper market in the United States to what goes on in the UK, although much smaller, is New York, in the sense that you have the New York Times and you have the two tabloids. Tabloid newspapers in the British sense, the Post and the News, not like the supermarket tabloids. That's to say, newspapers that carry real news but have very punchy layouts, have very, very feisty coverage, and are also in absolutely cutthroat competition with themselves.
Yeah.
But you imagine that multiplied by four. If instead of three newspapers, 12 newspapers, that's the market. And as in New York, You have the New York Times, which is somewhat left-leaning. That can be it's overstated by the Republicans. And you have two papers, the Post and the News, which are quite right-wing.
And when we look at what this competition, in a sense, helps to animate in Britain, it appears to have been the direct cause, along with a lack of journalistic ethics, of illegal phone hacking of young children, older children, parents, soldiers, celebrities, royalty, politicians, you name it. And that's really what has driven this inquiry, named after this law lord who's running at Leveson.
Yeah, this very senior judge known as Lord Leveson, who's actually may shortly be promoted to the most senior judgeship in Britain. It's very characteristic in the UK, number one, to have inquiries when these sort of big brouhahas blow up, and secondly, to have big establishment figures, often judges, to lead them, And the remit was of the inquiry was to look at the culture, practices, and ethics of the press. An interesting thing, because I do not think in this country it would be even, it would be unimaginable for there to be a government-sponsored inquiry into the culture, practice, and ethics of the press.
Now, as a lawyer, you can fill me in on this, Bill. Is that because of our First Amendment to the Constitution that such a thing would not happen?
Yes. The absolutism of the First Amendment here really means that although the press, of course, is subject to the law, there are defamation laws. They're not very strong, but they're there. Journalists don't have any special dispensation to commit crimes. But the direct interference in in things like the culture, practices, and ethics of the press would be unimaginable. Here in Europe, including in the UK, there's something of a different view of this. It's not that the press is not free. I mean, one of the problems or one of the things that drives this drove this report is that the press is actually really free, and I think goes further in many ways in both in its spirit of investigation and in its overall kind of what somebody recently described as its feral practices than pretty well any American newspapers outside the supermarket tabloids. But in Europe, there's a sort of different constitutional dispensation where the freedom of the press, which is enshrined in the European Convention of Human Rights, to which most countries, including the UK, are signatories, is balanced against the right of privacy, which is similarly given constitutional force. And so where privacy is violated in this country, well, you say that's unfortunate. In Europe, they say, well, no, actually, we have to have a balancing act, and there is a right to sanction the press, for instance, if they take long-distance photographs of near-naked members of the British royal family while they're on holiday.
And we saw this scandal erupt not long ago. Again, I'm just letting you know, listeners, I'm speaking with Bill Grantham, an entertainment attorney here in Los Angeles, about a recently released report on the press in Britain. And I wonder if you could tell us, Bill, what actually appears to be the principal recommendation of the report or recommendations and what's likely to happen in terms of their uptake.
Well, Leveson goes into a lot more detail over parts of his brief than he does over others. The headline has been over the proposals for regulation of the press. Now, clearly, just the word regulation emanating from the state raises a lot of hackles. What what I should say is that part of the problem, as everybody has agreed, is that there was a kind of self-regulating system that the press used called the Press Complaints Council, which was run by most of the big newspapers, not all of them, was staffed by newspaper editors. And was the degree of unanimity that this self-regulation was completely useless is such that when Leveson was announced, the Press Complaints Commission just stopped work in anticipation of its demise, of its own demise. So what Leveson has done is he said, well, look, the press can't regulate itself. You know, they've been bribing policemen. They've been cozying up to politicians in pursuit of their owners' business interests. They have been invading the privacy of innocent members of the public. They've been telling lies about innocent members of the public. They've just been behaving in a really horrible way, and their self-regulation has been a complete failure. At the same time, Leveson is clearly worried about the idea of the state imposing regulation on the press as a slippery slope, a shortcut to a kind of degree of governmental control, which I don't think anybody would find acceptable. So what he's come up with this, he said, the press has to get its house in order. It has to come up with a new set of practices. About how it conducts itself, the culture of reporting, of redefining what its ethics are. And what we'll do is we'll give you incentives to do this. We'll say, well, if you set up a new commission which has real teeth and has, for instance, allows arbitration of disputes between readers and print media, binding arbitration, we will give you breaks. Like, we'll make the cost of litigation much cheaper. We will not impose punitive damages if you get caught out doing this stuff. The trouble for Leveson, the sting in the tail, is because this is, what he's basically doing is he's trying to order the press to introduce a new voluntary system. And he needs a sting in the tail for if the press decides not to do it. And that's his big problem, because then he then goes on to say, well, we actually need legislation to regulate the press if they refuse to do it voluntarily. And I think politically that's going to be the big problem. He needs the stick with the carrot, but the government, including judging by what Prime Minister David Cameron said today in the House of Commons, they may not give him the stick. So the real issue is the press going to self-regulate in a way that's meaningful?
And I should say, now that I'm living in London, it's extraordinary the extent to which, for example, German and also US journalists have been invoked again and again by the bourgeois press in defense of their right to engage only in self-regulation. It's been quite bizarre. Well, I thank you for joining us, Bill Grantham. I've been speaking with Bill Grantham, an attorney whose practice focuses on the representation of a wide range of clients in connection with the development, financing, production, and, dare I say it, exploitation of motion pictures, television programs, and other forms of content. Bill's also worked as a management consultant advising major media interests, as a media exec, and as a journalist specializing in the international entertainment industry. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll be back with John Bellamy Foster discussing the global financial crisis and what it holds in store for the US and other countries. Stay with us. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters. And I'm joined now by John Bellamy Foster, John is editor of the Monthly Review, magazine, journal, whatever we might call it, and professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. His most recent books, they're both terrific, are The Great Financial Crisis, The Ecological Revolution, and his latest, which is with Robert McChesney, called The Endless Crisis, How Monopoly Finance Capital Produces Stagnation and Upheaval from the USA to China. Hello, John, and thank you for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about this new book which you've done with Bob, which is also published by Monthly Review Press, is it not?
Yes. Well, it's called The Endless Crisis, and what that refers to is what economists call stagnation. And everybody knows about the financial crisis, of course, that started in 2007, 2008, and really ended in some ways in 2009. That's when the recovery began in the United States, the economic recovery. But it's been a very, very slow recovery, and what we have is extremely, you know, slow economic growth. And the same thing exists even worse in Europe and Japan. So economists and political economists, concerned analysts, have now switched from focusing on financial crisis exclusively, and now they're focusing on stagnation, that is, this problem of slow growth. And actually, the slow growth has been developing for a long time. Stagnation has been developing in some ways since the 1970s. The economy has been slowing down in the United States and then the other advanced capitalist economies, so that the growth rate in the 1960s was higher than in the 1970s, and in the 1970s it was higher than in the 1980s and 90s, and then the first decade of this century was even slower still, and now we're stuck in this slow growth phase. This means there's higher unemployment, excess capacity, and all the attendant problems, along with increasing inequality, and there's no clear way out of this.
Well, one of the things that you
the parameters of the kind of economy we have.
One of the things that you and Robert McChesney say in the book, John Bellamy Foster, is that in many ways this is not about a blip. It's not about a 2 or 3 year disaster. It's about a trend, and you actually date the trend in some ways, I think, even earlier than you're saying now, because you are using some of the very interesting work of Barron and Sweezy, other writers from the 30s through to the 90s, showing that in many ways even the Great Depression of the 30s is not a blip. It's not just a discrete event. It's part of a wider trend that you've identified along with other political economists, isn't it?
Yes. Well, you know, the whole issue of stagnation rose in the 1930s. Basically, the problem of the Great Depression wasn't simply a problem of a very deep decline. I mean, there was the stock market crash in 1929, and then the economy went down in 1932. It hit 25% unemployment. But then the economy started to grow again, and they actually had a recovery for most of the 1930s. The problem was that the recovery was too slow, and then they got hit by another big recession in 1937, where the unemployment rate rose from 14% to 19%. And so they started to talk about stagnation, and of course Keynes was part of this. They started to talk about the problem of why advanced capitalist economies have so much trouble growing. They don't, that stagnation is actually the norm. It's the normal tendency of the system, and rapid growth is really an exception and is explained by special factors. And so we're building on that analysis. comes from Keynes, but it also comes in from Marx.
Sure, and I mean a whole stack of other people. If you even look at a lot of classical economy writing, folks are very concerned about things like the propensity of profit to fall and so forth over time, and issues to do with so-called labor market efficiencies and whatnot. I wonder if you could tell us how this applies to other countries, because one of the topics you look at in the book is China. And of course, China is both, in a sense, a figure of lust and desire for the United States and Europe, at the same time as it is an object of dependency, isn't it? So what does the future hold for China, which has been able to utilize historically low wage rates, a gigantic reserve army of labor, and authoritarian political control to become a major player in the world economy?
Well, it's a complicated problem. We have a more globalized economy, so that when the advanced capitalist countries, the rich economies, the advanced industrial economies slow down, this has effects on China too, because of course they're a very export driven economy, and they sell their goods mainly to the rich economies. So their markets, their export markets, are drying up. They've depended very much on a low wage system, and the multinational corporations multinational corporations centered in the West are crucial in carrying out production in China, and especially assembly, and then exporting it to the West. And of course, Chinese wages are only a small fraction of the wages in the West, so this keeps prices down. But their export markets are drying up because of stagnation in the rich economies, and China's had a 10% rate of growth for quite a while now. That means that the economy doubles in size basically every 7 years. Well, our rate of growth, let's say the rate of growth in the rich economies is now a little over 1%, which means it doubles in size every 70 years. So so you have these very different rates of growth, but China's economy is slowing down very rapidly. And even though they have a high rate of growth by Western standards, it's creating enormous problems for their system. They can't absorb all this labor they have. They have a vast number of surplus workers, migrant laborers, and they can't absorb it. And the answer that's proposed is for them to increase their internal consumption. But they can't do that without raising wages, and they can't do it without interfering with this migrant labor system, which is crucial to their whole economic model.
Right, where people may be coming from the rural north to be involved in manufacturing assembly in the south. Now, one of the other things you identify in the book, very tellingly, John Bellamy Foster, your book, The Endless Crisis with Robert McChesney, is that it's not just about comparative labor costs. That's not the only factor that makes the West limp along anemically in economic growth terms by contrast with China. It's also this word that you've utilized, that others have coined, but you draw on extensively in this wonderful new book, financialization. Can you tell us a bit about what financialization is?
Well, there's a lot of different views of financialization. I mean, it basically means the shift of the economy, the shift of the center of the gravity of the economy from production to finance. And this has been understood for a long time. In fact, the thinkers that we rely on very heavily Harry Magduff and Paul Sweezy started to analyze this process of financialization in the 1970s. They analyzed it on a very steady basis, and they saw it as arising out of the tendency towards stagnation, the slowdown of the economy. Basically, the profit margins of corporations are quite high because of particularly the more monopolistic or oligopolistic corporations. They have high profit margins, and so they have a great deal of surplus or savings at their disposal. But there's always a problem of effective demand. There's always a problem of final consumption, because the advanced capitalist countries tend to have market saturation, and there's a problem of investment because there tends to be, under this system, a lot of excess industrial capacity, and you don't want to invest in new plants and equipment if you have a lot of plants and equipment that's idle. So the system doesn't work very well, and the big problem is that there's more surplus available to the corporations than they are able to find profitable outlets for in production. And so increasingly what's happened is that they've poured this surplus capital into the financial sector. That's basically into speculation. And this has been made possible through the role of the state as the lender of the last resort, propping up the financial sector again and again. Every time a bubble is about to burst, the state tries to intervene and prop up the financial sector. So we've had something that we've never seen before in history, a shift towards finance within the economy that's been going on, that's happened over decades, and accompanying stagnation. And the problem keeps on getting worse and worse. Even with this latest financial crisis, they didn't really let the bubble burst fully. They didn't let the system go. They propped it up. And so we still have the same problem of a bloated financial system on top of a slow-growing economy. The financial system is basically debt and credit and debt, and it's primarily in the form of private debt and not government debt. Government debt is a relatively minor factor in this. So we have a system that doesn't work very well on the level of production and tries to lift itself through finance and speculation.
Now, speaking of this issue of growth and the lack of growth, John Bellamy Foster, one of the other things you're renowned for is being one of the canaries that we have in thinking about ecological issues. In other words, you're not just one of these people who is a prophet and profit, as it were, of growth. You want to think about issues of sustainability as well, and not just sustainability in conventional bourgeois economic terms, but sustainability in terms of the climate of the earth. So where does that play into all of this?
Well, it's very complicated. I've just finished an article, The Planetary Emergency, which is going to come out in Monthly Review in the December issue. In fact, it'll be out online on the first, but it's a very difficult problem because ecologically, economic growth is a problem. Well, the system is stagnating, and we have all of these problems of unemployment and poverty and all the manifestations of a failed growth economy that is hurting people so much. Economic growth is actually bad for the environment. this kind of failed growth economy isn't exactly good for the environment, this sort of slow growth economy, because we tend to, as growth slows down, we tend to pull out all the environmental regulations and environmental stops, and so we tend to be even more vicious towards the environment if we're having a problem of getting growth going. But right now, it's very clear in terms of climate change. The latest science is out. If you read, let's say, the latest issue of Nature Climate Change, the September issue at any rate, there's an article by Kevin Anderson, one of the leading climate change scientists. And he's basically, it's clear now that we can't avoid the 2 degrees Celsius threshold, which scientists refer to as the point of irreversibility or the point of no return. That's, if we get there, then we can no longer go back. Mitigation is over, and all we can try to do is to adapt to an increasing environmental catastrophes. And so scientists are terrified by this, and it's clear now that the mathematics of it are really clear that we can't avoid hitting 2 degrees Celsius unless we shift the economy into a zero growth mode. And that's what they're saying in the scientific community now. Well, I mean, this is impossible under capitalism. We've really reached a point where capitalism has got us into this trap of stagnation and financialization and going over the ecological precipice. And we've really got to make changes quickly now.
Wise words. I thank you for joining us, John Bellamy Foster.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with John Bellamy Foster, who is editor of the excellent magazine Monthly Review. He mentioned that he has a new article coming out that will be available online in a day or so. In addition, John is professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. His latest book with Robert McChesney is called The Endless Crisis: How Monopoly Finance Capital Produces Stagnation and Upheaval from the USA to China. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with Andre Dorce Ramos about what the new sexenio in Mexico may bring to the media landscape and associated topics. Don't touch that dial. Hi, this is Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters. And joining us now is Dr. Andre Dorce Ramos, a lecturer researcher in the Communication Sciences Department of the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana Coajimalpa in Mexico City. In addition to that position, Andre is also the ombudsman for the public broadcasting Canal 22, Channel 22, television station, and he is currently working on a book about critical perspectives on media convergence, as well as collaborating with several local and regional initiatives for progressive change in media legislation in Mexico. Oye, André, how are you, sir?
I'm very happy to hear you, and thank you very much for having me on your show now.
It's great to have you. Sorry we weren't able to start the show with you, but it's good to have you to take us to the top of the hour. André, I think I'm right in saying December 1, just a couple of days from now, is when the new president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, comes to power. Your response to that?
Well, first of all, you have to take into account, of course, that the feeling right now is it's kind of very sour in a sense, and sad as well. You have to take into account that Presidente Calderón, who's now leaving office, is giving us a country with approximately 90,000 deaths resulting from his war to the drug cartels, etc., with no clear and effective strategy. So, in that sense, there seems to be a lot of sadness in a lot of people, but also a certain kind of weird relief in the sense that this strategy will be stopped, probably stopped, and we now face a new situation with President-elect Peña Nieto. So there seems to be some hope that this approach will be changed substantially.
I guess one of the problems, of course, that doesn't go away is here in the United States, we supply the arms for all sides of the conflict. We also supply the demand for the drugs. So what can Mexico do on its own, absent criminalization of arms here and decriminalization of drugs here?
Yes, of course. That's a very important point. And wouldn't seem to be able so far to build and to construct a joint policy to try to tackle this. And I don't see any, soon solution to this kind of problem, because you have to take into account also growing rates of poverty in Mexico and inequality. So it's a rather complex problem that I don't think a comprehensive drug policy would ever solve, actually.
Right. Now, thinking at the media level, where you're a specialist, you mentioned some optimism, some hope in terms of the new administration. People all around the world, people I know from all walks of life, have been very inspired by the social movement of young people, particularly university students, college students, Yo Soy 132. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that movement, how it arose during, of course, the election that resulted in the success of Enrique Peña Nieto, and where you think it's headed now.
Well, as you know, we had 1st of July, we had election day, and before that, we had the whole electric campaign, and the main three candidates were, traveling through many, public places doing their job, trying to publicize their political program, etc. Enrique Peña Nieto went to Universidad Iberoamericana, the Iberoamericana University, which is an elite university for Mexicans, and when he was at the Ibero, he kind of proclaimed the media that covered the visit of Peña Nieto to Ibero proclaimed that some students who were legitimately protesting against his presence in the university, claiming that while he was governor of the Estado de Mexico, he actually allowed the assassination of peasants in a peaceful protest. So the main media, mostly Televisa and some other outlets, said that these young students that were protesting against Peña Nieto were, members of the opposing parties, etc. And students basically reacted very strongly against that sort of coverage, claiming that they were not part of any petition group or anything. They were just, young students protesting against something they would claim was unfair and illegal. So that gave the context in which Yo Soy 132 was formed.
And they held up their student ID cards, didn't they, to say, look, I really am a student at the Universidad Iberoamericana. And
exactly.
Then it became a case of not just the 131 that were protesting,
exactly,
but the idea of an endlessly expanding group. And the media became a big focus of their demands, didn't it?
Yes, as you rightly say, they produced this small video where all participating members of that protest were showing their IDs, university IDs. They were 131, and they put it up in YouTube, and then it kind of became like the main theme that they were trying to, you know, actually asking for better news coverage. And then the media became like the focus of the whole movement. And they, you know, the street protests became bigger and bigger, and they gained a huge momentum before the election day. They articulated in many ways with some other social movements around the world, particularly with the Occupy movement and Indignados in Spain, etc. So it was quite a show of engagement and interest for the betterment of the country in a time where most people were thinking less about the students.
Now, one of the things that Mexico faces, like the United States, like so many countries, is, depending on your point of view, an oligopolistic or monopolistic media system. What sorts of reforms are needed to television, radio, telecommunications in Mexico, do you think?
Well, we just had a very interesting meeting in Guadalajara, where I actually also participated with Yo Soy 132, in trying to figure out which kind of media reform would we need to change these monopolistic and oligopolistic practices that have characterized most of Mexican media landscape. There's been a lot of work, actually, through the last 20 years, and there's many social civil society groups that have worked on it, also within the universities as well. And we have actually produced a very specific proposal that tries to redistribute the licenses for the management of media, electronic media in general. So one really important thing is how the electromagnetic spectrum is being, you know, shared or
allocated,
split between different actors
and
companies, and that's one of the main points. And we're trying now. We're hoping that with the change of government that's happening next Saturday, will we have a chance to push forward this new initiative in terms of trying to get to this better, more democratizing media law.
Now, that's interesting because, of course, the political party that Peña Nieto works for, works with, leads, depending on your perspective, is the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the PRI, which has governed Mexico for most of the last century and is precisely, in a sense, the institution most clearly responsible for this incredible concentration of media power. So do you think it's realistic to look to the PRI as a potential source of reform?
Well, probably is not realistic. Nevertheless, the PRI right now is not, probably is not exactly the same, and they're not in total control of the government right now. There's a bigger opposition now. They're going to have to negotiate a lot in order to regain some sort of legitimacy because, as you know, there were lots of claims that the elections were not fair and probably legal, although there was no... we couldn't actually produce any legal... I put this into bracket, legal evidence that it was not, you know, specifically legal. But nevertheless, what I'm trying to say is that they lack, Peña Nieto's now government is going to lack a lot of legitimacy within different political groups. So they need to negotiate. In that sense, this could be an opportunity to push forward this reform, this media reform. But also, we haven't seen any, you know, positive sign that... tell us otherwise, anyway.
I'm speaking with Dr. André Dorce Ramos, a lecturer researcher at the Communication Sciences Department of the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana Coajimalpa in Mexico City. He's also ombudsman with public broadcasting Canal 22. Could I ask you, André Dorce Ramos, about Canal 22, Channel 22, which, of course, many people watch here in the United States as well as in Mexico, and your role as ombudsman, is that any kind of model of what a reformed media landscape might look like?
Well, in this media reform, the most complete media reform proposal that has been put forward has been done by the Media Asociación Mexicana de Derecho a la Información, which has been to get brought together a lot, lots of academicians, you know, media producers, and different sectors of society to put together this very sophisticated media reform. In that reform, in that proposal, we are actually suggesting that to have a you know, like a sort of media ombudsman for the whole country would be something positive. That's one possible way to go. Also, that all media outlets have some sort of ethical codes and someone like an ombudsperson to try to deal with and interact with audiences in terms of what they need, how they are being represented, etc. So in terms of channel, what we're doing in Channel 22, in a way, is definitely a model, but Channel 22 is not the only instance of this kind of work being done in Mexico. There's also a few other public outlets, media outlets, that are working with this figure. So we're still trying to consolidate the way in which we work with this, and we're also trying to understand how, you know, efficient and powerful could be this be to mediate between the media institutions and the audiences.
Could you give us an example, André, of your work at Channel 22, Canal 22, in that role? What are some of the things that you do to represent the interests of the audience?
Well, there's different things. There's sort of more, you know, everyday things, very small things that audiences, TV viewers ask for Canal 22, like, you know, trying to change the schedule and the way in which some shows are programmed and broadcast in terms of the time where they are broadcast, etc. Those are kind of like very...
sort of nuts and bolts issues, aren't they? Yeah, very pragmatic ones.
Very pragmatic issues, but they are important as well, because they're talking about their everyday lives and how they actually work and use entertainment and information as well. So those things have to be taken into account. In that regard, we try to make proposals or suggestions to recommendations to the authorities within the channel to try to take this into account and be more flexible in the way they program their shows and their programs. That's one example. But there's also some other things, like more controversial things about how religion is being represented in some shows. So some people that are religious, they complain that they're being misrepresented, and some, you know, I try then to mediate and trying to find a reasonable answer from the station, from the authorities of the station, trying to explain why they show these sort of representations and why they think they should do that. And then we follow up into that, the answer that we put forward to the audiences, and we try to sort of put the two sides in a better place in which there's more understanding on the way television works, and also the way in which audiences, you know, legitimately can demand for the public station some certain types of change.
Could I ask you one more question, André? It relates to both this question of widening inequality in Mexico that you raised earlier and this other question of representation that you've just mentioned. I'm interested in what can be done for those groups who are traditionally silenced, excluded, misrepresented. And of course, these vary across the world and across time, but I'm thinking in particular maybe of non-Spanish speakers amongst many indigenous peoples in Mexico.
Yes,
I'm thinking of Afro-Mexicans, campesinos, peasants, and so forth. What kind of right of redress or right to representation should there be, say, for Afro-Mexicans?
Well, that's a very important issue here in Mexico, where we have actually for whole Latin America, I would say. But here in Mexico, we have a huge intercultural diversity. And clearly, when we have this media monopoly, that is certainly not, it's not open to hold this whole diversity in trying to, you know, cover the stories, showing them, showing their faces on TV, their stories, etc. We definitely need not only to represent them, but also to give the chance for many of us to self-representation. And that's one main point that we're trying to push forward in this media reform proposal that we put together, which is that in terms of regional media, there's a lot of groups that should have definitely their radio station, community radio station, or community stations, also for local TV stations, but also trying to find a way to articulate this in a national level, and also trying to show how diverse we are and how the conditions under which we could actually kind of start to see each other. Now, in terms of Afro-Mexicans, of Afro-descendants, Mexican Afro-descendants, it's interesting because it's a very, very small portion of people. Actually, right now, there's some studies that have been made in terms of trying to historicize the censuses that were made during the colony the colonization process by the Spanish monarchy. And basically, at some point in the 18th century, Afro-Mexicans were the second largest population before even Spaniards. So after indigenous people, Afro-descendants were the second largest population in Mexico. Nowadays, according to CONAPER, which is the National Council for to Prevent discrimination, it's less than 1% of the Mexican population, which is basically based in Guerrero, Oaxaca, Coahuila, Michoacan, different states. Mm-hmm. So they do remain quite invisible, partly because the original condition as a slave, but partly also because the way in which mestizaje, which is the mixture of different heritages, actually works as a way of thinking about identity in Mexico and in Latin America. So the challenges are many because CONAPRED has now established that also, like indigenous people or Afro-descendants in Mexico are the poorest and the groups with more, social vulnerability and poverty, etc. So there's a huge problem there, and also we think that hearing their voices, seeing them representing themselves and talking to each other, we could have a better picture of the difference and the diversity, the cultural diversity that lies and lives in Mexico.
I've been speaking with André d'Orsay Ramos. André, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Toby.
André is a lecturer researcher at the Communication Sciences Department of the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana Coajimalpa in Mexico. He is also ombudsman with public broadcasting Canal 22, Channel 22. He's currently working on a book on critical perspectives for media convergence and collaborating with various regional and local initiatives for progressive change to media legislation in Mexico. Well, this has been Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon in the soundproof booth. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, and you can follow me at tobymiller.org. Ian will return on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.